There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free, and things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Along with me, the one, the only, Mr. Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hey there.
We got a lot of news to cover today, a lot of cool stories to share, and we've got a couple of special guests dropping by today. How about that? Do you feel excited? We've got a lot bubbling on the program today.
I do feel excited, yeah.
Excellent. Listen, I also want to make a quick mention to people. There's no live show this week, no live radio show on Thursday night. I will be at the Minnesota Para-Unity Convention in Duluth, Minnesota, at the Duluth Convention Center. It's July 8th through the 10th. If you're interested, go to darknessevents.com, get your tickets, come on out and see me. Next week, I'll be at the Strange Escapes Haunted in Havana, a paranormal weekend at the Belvoir Winery. You can find information, again, at darknessevents.com. The Belvoir Winery, it's the Oddfellows Asylum. It's a really cool old location. We've been there a few times. We're going to be back out there. Amy Bruni, Adam Berry, Cindy Kaza from the Holzer Files, myself, Aaron Sagers. I believe John Tenney's going to be on hand. So there's a lot of cool guests, a lot of fun stuff going on, plus investigations at the Belvoir Winery. We're looking forward to seeing you. So make sure you go check it out and keep up to date with all of the cool events we've got going on. Darknessevents.com. That's darknessevents.com. Joining us first up is a longtime friend of the show. We had him on with his first book, Ghost Crimes, which was a book based on real paranormal activity. He has his new book, the follow-up, Ghost Crimes, The Paranormal Enemy, book two in the Ghost Crime series. Gary Allen is back with us. Great to have you here. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Dave. It's good to be here. I'm in Tampa, Florida, and a recent survivor of Hurricane Elsa.
Good grief. You guys are getting pounded. Our other guest who's joining us in a little bit is also there in the midst of the storm. So we're going to be talking to two of you in Florida today, but you're safe. Everything's good.
Yeah, so as far as hurricanes go, I've lived in Florida all my life, so I'm a little judgy, but it was more hurricane light. It was just barely a hurricane, so we got through it pretty unscathed.
what do they classify that? Is that more like a tropical storm?
So tropical storm, and then once you get to 75 miles per hour, then you're essentially a hurricane, and I think it was 75 miles per hour. So Elsa barely got the title.
So disgusting. Elsa, come on, a little bit more effort. Well, I'm glad
you're
okay.
I really expected more from her, Dave.
I'm glad you're okay. I'm glad everything's going well. So the new book is out. I know your first book was based on actual true paranormal accounts that law enforcement had shared with you. Where do we go in book two?
So in book two, I do have a splattering of some stories left over from the first one. But overall and mostly, it is a fiction story. So Detective Burke, for those that didn't read the first book, very troubled detective, suffered from a lot of loss in his life, isolationist, borderline alcoholic, and he endured a possession case in 1996, and he was on the verge of self-destruction until he was paired with Detective Garrison, who helped him climb out of a very dark space. So I brought them into the second book. We're 18 months further into the story, and Burke has slimmed himself down. He's physically much healthier, but still mentally and emotionally very troubled from his paranormal trauma. So he's teamed up with someone else named David, and they do paranormal get-togethers and therapist sessions and help people out. And the crux of the story is, unfortunately, he is reluctantly dragged into an investigation of a haunted house. So he's brought back with what he calls face-to-face with the darkness. And so that's where we see him now in book two.
Very cool. And when you're talking, and I mean, obviously having ties and connections to law enforcement, are you finding that they're still pretty open with sharing real life encounters and strange calls that they've gotten that they really just don't know how to deal with?
Yeah. Moreover, now they're willing to give up the information. They still want to remain anonymous, but as they start talking and they sort of say, okay, you know, I didn't laugh at them. I didn't call them a name. I didn't think they were ridiculous. So now, okay, I'm going to tell this guy some more. And then the floodgates open. And there were several, you know, occurrences or experiences that they had. And it's therapeutic, you know, just to talk about something is the first step towards getting past it. So they have an audience now. And in Ghost Crimes 2, I gave those folks an audience, and it's a weekly group that meets and they share their stories. And it's not so much so they can figure out, you know, we don't always know why the paranormal happens or are able to define it, but just sharing it with other people who had similar experiences is definitely therapeutic and a start down the road to recovery.
With this book, obviously you've taken the first book, again, kind of a novelization, but based on all of these real paranormal encounters and stories, you're taking that story in a novel form, even more so novelistic in the second book. Is this kind of a cathartic method for you too in writing to share some of these stories, deal with the supernatural and tie them into these kind of true crime books?
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, two things. You know, one is I've always been a proponent of showing great respect and support for our first responders out there. You know, these folks literally leave their homes and their families in the morning and say, I'm going to go put my life on the line for strangers, see at five. And I can't imagine living that life. It's selfless. It's just an amazing thing that these folks do. And it really bothers me when they don't get the due credit. So to be able to write and show these folks and the stories overcoming, and of course they're driven, they're going through the darkness because they want to save lives. Burke wants to save lives. Garrison wants to save lives. That's what this is all about. So it's completely selfless and it's just amazing. So if I can do that for them, you know, that I feel better with when I put pen to paper. And, you know, having gone through my own paranormal experiences in 1999, I bought a house that was haunted and I studied metaphysics for many years and studied reincarnation and astral projection and, you know, had a lot of spooky things happen to me throughout the years. And now I'm able to put it down. And if I can share what happened with me, whether it's through a fictional story or, you know, accounting exactly what happened, someone else can say, oh my God, I had no idea that's what that was that happened to me, or that could be what happened to me. Now that makes sense. I'm not going crazy, you know, or I'm not in danger. You know, these are natural things that happen at times. And so, yeah, I mean, I hope that my stories reach people in that way.
What, if any, paranormal experiences have you had in the years between your first book and the new book? Have things continued for you as well, Gare?
They have. And I was looking for a new house not long ago, and both the owners had passed away within 6 months of themselves. And I just felt the presence there, and I knew it was the wife. And I don't consider myself psychic or empathic, but it was palpable. And I think over time, the more exposed we are to the paranormal, you just start to pick up on stuff, you know, with your third eye or your sixth sense, whatever you want to call it. And so I went home, and it was just the house was just heavy with energy. So I went home and I woke up in the middle of the night and I went to the bathroom. And as soon as I walked in the bathroom, a towel didn't fall off the counter. It literally flew across the bathroom and landed in the shower. And I was like, okay, I know it's this woman who owned the house. I just know it. And I reached out to.
Or is it time to wash that towel, Gare? Was your towel trying to tell you it's time to get out a new one, boy?
I guess I wasn't as tidy as she preferred I'd be. I'm not sure. But, you know, I reached out to a friend of mine and said, you know, does remote cleansing. And I said, hey, can you check on my house? And, you know, I have a salt and holy water barrier around the house, but I think I brought something home from this house I saw. And I didn't say anything else. And he came back with, yeah, there was an elderly woman in your house. And that's exactly, you know, who I picked up in the house. And so that was the most recent event. So it's innocuous, you know, a towel flying across. Oh, I'll take it. But it kind of reminds me that, you know, even with that sea salt holy water barrier that I put around my home on the doors, the windows, sometimes maybe that only keeps out the darker energies. And this was a positive one. So it was able to come through. Who knows?
Sea salt, isn't that kind of just what's right off the coast there for you? Aren't you getting that briny sea salt constantly bathing your house? Maybe that's what's keeping the spirits locked in around Florida.
You know, I actually thought that's a great point. I actually thought about that. I'm like, if I put the barrier up while they're in the house, are they now trapped?
Right. Right. And then what if you get one of these nasty storms blowing up a bunch of seawater? Are they now locking all of the spiritual essence and flavor inside the house? You're like a giant paranormal Tupperware bowl.
I hope that's not the case. On all the TV shows I've seen, they get yanked out when that happens. So I'm hoping that's what happens.
We can only hope. The book is out and available right now. We've got a link for it up in today's show guide. Garrett, it's always a pleasure catching up to you. Congratulations on the success of your books, and we hope this one takes off for you as well.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you, Tim. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, my friend. Thank you so much. And stay safe in that tropical storm, barely hurricane. Now, Tim, we have to call Aaron Sagers on it later. If he calls in to tell us how horrible it is, we're just going to have to call him weak because Gare Allen told us the truth. It was barely a hurricane.
Yeah. Elsa didn't even really let it go, did she?
No, not at all.
See? I was hoping we were going to get through this without something like that happening. But
All right. Thanks a lot, Gare. All right. Let's dig in. We've got some news stories to share from around the world. A lot of strange tales have popped up this week, Tim. A man claims he saw Bigfoot in his garden while going to get a glass of water. That's right. A believer says he saw this mythical Bigfoot creature, Sasquatch, lurking in his backyard. Where, Tim? Florida Panhandle, after he looked out his kitchen window. See, if it were anywhere else in the world, I might believe it. But, you know, with as weird as Florida man is, I'm just not sure that it's not Florida man swaddled in a giant mink coat being weird. A man has sensationally claimed he saw a Bigfoot while going into the kitchen for a glass of water while he was home alone. In a TikTok video uploaded by paranormal author Connor Flynn, who previously told the Daily Star about an alleged Sasquatch thumb fossil he found.
thumb fossil?
Yeah, that should be the name of our band going forward, Tim. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the stage, Sasquatch Thumb Fossil.
That is a great name, by the way. Yeah,
it is. He interviews a man at InfinityCon with a grade A encounter. The man is called Royce and describes the chilling experience and says, I was at home alone. My folks had left the house and I got a glass of water and I looked out the back window. And there is, I can only describe it as a Bigfoot walking away back out of the woods. I paused for a second and thought to myself, you dummy, take your phone out, get a picture, get a video. He says he threw his glass of water down and rushed to get his phone and take a quick picture, but was unable to record footage because this mystical beast had already wandered off. By the time I tried to get a video, it was gone, he says ruefully. The witness tells Connor as soon as his computer is working, he can provide evidence of the encounter and send it to y'all.
Mm-hmm. Oh, y'all. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That means he's serious, son.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Since it was uploaded on June 12th, the video has sparked reactions of both excitement and ridicule. Hard to believe, Tim. Some people are excited. Some people think he's nuts.
No.
Really? In the paranormal world, it's true. Although the Bigfoot myth is popular in the U.S. and has a large following in paranormal circles, many people admitted they were skeptical and found the man's story unlikely. One viewer gushed, "Where was this? I'm excited to see." Awesome, said another, but someone else blasted, there ain't zero Bigfoot in Florida. Yeah, that's well stated. Good science there behind that comment.
Yeah.
Hey, they're called the skunk ape there.
Yeah.
Right? The skunk ape, the woolly booger. I think there's a couple other weird, the wild man. Another viewer commented, really? His computer isn't working? Why can't he produce the pic on his phone? Oh, somebody's thinking it through. Nice job, Columbo.
Yeah.
Connor said the man saw the beast in the Florida Panhandle, which has been the location of many other unconfirmed sightings, as reported in the Daily Star. A man saw a hulking dark figure that he thought might be Bigfoot walking across a field next to a woodland and actually recorded the footage for people to debate over. So some people have seen it and have shown the video and have not conveniently had their computers crash, Tim.
I find that hard to believe.
Well, Tim, maybe, just maybe it's because the computers are being protected by demons.
Well, it could be too.
Yeah. Because exorcisms are on the rise as demons now can attack you through texts, according to a priest.
What?
Yeah. We didn't have enough to worry about now.
Yeah.
A Catholic priest performs up to 20 exorcisms every week to free people and their homes from what he calls demons and satanic evil. Stephen Joseph Rossetti, age 70, claims he's seen countless demons at work over his 13 years in the exorcism business, and apparently it's just getting worse. From TVs turning on and off to people spewing foreign objects like nuts and bolts, the professor and priest has revealed all in his new book, Diary of an American Exorcist, Demons, Possession, and the Modern Day Battle Against Ancient Evil. Speaking to the New York Post, the 70-year-old said how exorcisms have grown exponentially over the past 10 years. He added, I think this is going to get much worse before it gets better. Since technology has improved, the priest claims demons have been finding new ways to get at people. Stephen said a woman contacted him after an upside-down cross appeared burned into her shoulder. This supposedly happened while her father was receiving evil text messages from demons. Are they drunk text messages? Hey, we should get back together. I miss you, man. The messages were being sent from her phone number, but Joseph claims there was no evidence of her sending them herself. He continued, by the way, several exorcists have had the same experience, getting texts from demons. And why not? In the past, they've messed with electronics, TVs, and lights turning off and on by themselves. Now they're messing with cell phones. The priest claims he has seen things that are not humanly possible, although admits he's never witnessed levitation or spinning heads, just demon texting, Tim. Stephen claims he has truly experienced out-of-this-world evil. Recalling one exorcism, he wrote, they were wagging the woman's finger at me and shaking her head. I had been commanding the demons to leave, and the response was pretty clear. No. The priest poured holy water on the woman, which reportedly caused her body to wildly spasm. This is because, according to Stephen, holy water engulfs demons in holy torture, worse than the fires of hell. The priest has admitted that many of the people who contact him, thinking they're possessed, are suffering with a mental illness. But he says he has seen enough real things to believe. He says everyone should be doing more to protect themselves from demonic attack by putting crucifixes up in your room, as well as religious statues, and having holy water inside. I don't know, man. I gotta question that, because in every horror movie, Tim, if you've got that stuff, they get broken.
Yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
They get broken. They get crucifixes just get turned upside down.
Mm-hmm.
Because demons, any self-respecting demon knows, if I just flip this sucker over, I'm in control now, man.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, they tend to be one step ahead. I'm still stuck on one thing about this whole story, Dave, and that is demons texting. Just fiery fat fingering a keyboard to me is, I have a tough enough time. I mean, you know, I've got the old, I'm of the Apple crowd. I've got the old, the digital keyboard, on iOS,
right,
so
right.
It barely senses my fat fingers when I'm typing. And occasionally I miss a letter or two, and I have to go back and I have to redo the letters. I can't imagine how it senses a demon's fiery fingers.
You think he's like, I see you, and I'm going to pull your soul, and you're going to burn in the eternal fiery flames of Bell, of gel, of gel. Oh, yep. God damn it. Of hell, hell, hell.
Yep. And then you've got the intuitive, I wonder if they do the intuitive thing where, they're trying to use the intuitive feature on it too. And they're like, I'm going to take your bowl, soul. And then they get all, upset with. And then if they try to use, like Siri, I would think Siri would probably be a problem with them, because Siri probably doesn't understand the demonic voices.
Well, and the one big thing you got to keep in mind, Tim, about this is most likely in hell, mm-hmm. because it's got to live up to its name. You know that they're still paying per text.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because that is the equivalent of hell, having to pay per text.
Yeah,
for those messages.
There's no unlimited texting in hell. No.
Mm-mm. Do you think they use a lot of poop emojis?
They do. Yeah.
A lot of demonic poop emojis. We have an email here. Dave and Tim, as I was catching up from last week's episodes, I was listening to the episode which mentions diplomats being exposed to electromagnetic radiation, and bells started ringing in my memory. I read a book back in 1985 which went into great detail about this very phenomena. It describes specific frequencies of EM radiation, duration of exposure, and the specific medical maladies it caused. It cited specific incidents with antenna located in buildings across the street from embassies. In fact, the entire book is about the relationship between electricity and the human body. In a related chapter, the author mentioned experiments at EM frequencies around 400 hertz, where it targets the tissue in the human ear such that you can the amplitude modulate a human voice on a 400 hertz carrier, and only the person targeted will hear your voice. The idea was to use this for sending orders to soldiers in the field via satellite when those troops are scattered across the area and most of them don't have radios. Most of the investigations are experiments from and are from the perspective of helping soldiers. Of course, it's always about helping, Tim, and military in general, although limb and organ regrowth would obviously help us all. The slant toward the military is due to the author being a surgeon and researcher for an upstate medical center in New York, as well as a director of orthopedic surgery at the Veterans Administration Hospital, also in New York. The author is Robert Otto Becker, who unfortunately passed in 2008 at the age of 85. The book is called The Body Electric. Thanks for the great show, and that comes from John.
And if I remember right, actually the guy who was on 60 Minutes was mentioning too that the microwaves or electromagnetic frequency that was being used was right around the 400 hertz spectrum too. So, I mean, not that it was any new information per se, but he was verifying that scientifically the government had verified that the frequency was being measured. So essentially what they were saying was our government was verifying that China and Cuba had both used this weapon, which is new information. That was the new information of the article. Jeez. Is that our crazy government had verified that these two governments had been using that weapon. And that's what was so astonishing, is that our government had recognized it, but yet, and had been paying for treatment to these diplomats that had been hit by it, but then all of a sudden went back on that and said, well, now we're no longer going to treat you for it. So they had accepted it and then denied it all in the same stroke over a 1 year period of time.
Welcome to the government, folks.
Yeah, exactly.
We got another email here. Enjoying listening to the podcast today. You're wondering why the Prince of Liechtenstein would be interested in Roswell. Well, when I was growing up, the Prince of Liechtenstein owned the farm ranch just east of my aunt and uncle's farm in Delta County, Texas, northeast Texas. Of course, I'm sure that the prince is dead now, but the situation caused me to notice when there was a news article about how the Prince of Liechtenstein invested a lot of his considerable wealth in land in the U.S. I think that Liechtenstein royalty is simply very interested in the U.S. I do recall that the prince, the older one, liked to come to the U.S. My aunt and uncle met him when he came to visit his ranch. Keep on podcasting, and that comes from Brenda Lee. Well, that's our hopes. We're hoping to keep podcasting, keeping things moving.
But the same Brenda Lee who used to sing?
No, I don't think so, Tim.
All right.
Okay. Nope.
Just curious.
That was my ghost train sound, Tim. You like that?
Yeah, we have a ghost train now, or what's the deal?
Oh, we do. Oh. We do. As a matter of fact, Plymouth is home to many old and abandoned train lines and railway-related artifacts. Some have been removed and now serve as pleasant cycle paths. Some are derelict and overgrown. One that cuts through the heart of the city is widely believed to be abandoned, but in fact still operates to this day. The train was once one of the many modes of transportation, and lines ran all over Plymouth to places far and wide. Railway and tram tracks were in place all over the city, allowing people to travel from A to B, but also allowing goods to get to and from the warehouses and fishing industries by the harbor. One such line still exists in plain view, running alongside Tothill Park and separating Lipson from Prince Rock. with hundreds of meters of metal, Plymouth Live reports. The line formerly ran from Plymouth Friary Station, which is now demolished and was better known as the White Friars Court Housing Estate and Friary Retail Park. You can still see the old pillars of the entrance if you go by there today. Despite the line now going nowhere with the track coming to an end on the east side of Tot Hill Road Bridge, in recent weeks, shocked locals were taken aback when they spotted a locomotive chugging along. I think I can. It's kind of crazy. Plymouth's rail history and why locals claim to have seen a ghost train is one of the city's more intriguing elements. The end of the line, two buffer stops mark the end of the former Plymouth Friary Railway Station. The station itself was demolished in 1976, but prior to its deconstruction, it operated both passenger services as well as a goods depot. So people are seeing a ghost train, not just one or two drunkards, to many drunkards, maybe not drunkards. Maybe that's an unfair assessment, but we do have pictures up of the site, the location, the story. You can go check it out for yourself at darknessradio.com. Click on the news and you will see it. There's no ghost train in the photographs, but you can see the area around it and hear that. But man, that's kind of creepy. Wouldn't that be weird? You think demons, you think ghosts, those are pretty weird. But like, if all of a sudden you just saw like this ghost train whizzing past you, that to me is, there's something really unnerving and freaky about that.
But then if it were a really convincing ghost train, would you really know if it were a ghost train or a real train?
Well, I'm sure it looks like a ghost train, Tim. It's white and ethereal. And instead of saying whoo, whoo, it says boo, boo as it runs through town. No?
Maybe, I guess.
Hey, Tim,
yeah.
Pull them shekels together, son, because a haunted village in Scotland is on sale for just $173,000. And it comes with a private beach and 17th century ruins. How about that? The old village of Lars. Why can't I say that? L-A-W-E-R-S. Lars. The old village of Lars is on the shore of Loch Tay in Perthshire. It covers 3.31 acres and comes with a private beach, native woodland, and fishing rights on the loch, according to Goldcrest Land and Forestry Group. The old village consists of 17th century ruins, including the House of Lars, a site that stands on the former home of the Lady of Lars, who is said to haunt the village to this day, Tim. The Lady of Lars was remembered for her prophecies, which apparently became true. And things that she said became true up to this day, John Lambert, a partner at Goldcrest Land and Forestry Group, told The Insider. Lars correctly predicted that the village's church would be damaged in a thunderstorm. She also predicted a ship driven by smoke along before the construction of steamships, according to Goldcrest. It is a very special place, and while all properties are unique in their own way, this is perhaps more uniquer than others, Tim. Mm. Yeah, you heard me. Some places are unique. This is more uniquer, adding to its location as a selling point. Perthshire is one of the most desirable, if not the most desirable, county of Scotland. He says Loch Tay is a stunning part of the world, and if you're lucky enough to capture a bit of good weather, it's truly world class. According to Goldcrest, just 17 people were reported as living by the loch in the old village in 1841 census. By 1891, there were just 7 people. And then it was abandoned completely by 1926. So you get all that freedom to walk around naked, Tim, that you want.
Wow.
Yeah. And if I come by and I see you naked, I'm going to go, hey, lock it up, man. Lock it up. See what I did there?
See,
I think with
did.
The whole COVID scene, some of these places become more and more precious, in my opinion, with more and more people becoming less enthusiastic to jump on planes to the other side of the world, Lambert said. And these little spots of paradise are certainly generating a huge amount of interest. We launched the property on Friday and have been inundated with inquiries and questions. So get your bid in quick, Tim. If you do it quick, maybe you'll be able to get it for like 185,000 quid and a head of haggis. Maybe that would get the deal done for you.
Huh.
I don't know. Yeah. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well,
I could be wrong.
No, I don't think you are. I just don't know where I'd come up with that many quid.
Man. Well, if you were a pro, you'd know where to go. Then you'd be quid pro go. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, Aaron Sagers joins us, believe it or not, next, right here on Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the program. This is the best in paranormal podcasting. You're tuned in to Darkness Radio. I'm Dave. That's Tim. Joining us now, live from the storm. Florida's being punished enough, Tim, with the storm, but they also have Aaron Sagers on hand. Ladies and gentlemen, Aaron Sagers. How you doing, my friend?
Hey, guys. Thanks so much for having me on. That's right. I'm in the midst of Tropical Storm Elsa right now.
Oh, he's keeping it real. See, Gare Allen, previous guest, told us it was upgraded to a hurricane because it managed to get to that 75-mile-an-hour wind. Maybe where you're at, it stayed at like 74.6 and didn't make it all the way. But I'm glad to know that it's just tropical storm for you. Is it pretty brutal to see it happen or what?
Actually, no. I mean, that's the irony of it. I grew up in Florida, and the worst hurricane I ever endured was in Central Florida. I grew up here, but the worst one I ever endured was actually Sandy in New York City. So, no, this one is actually pretty mild, pretty tame. Elsa did not arrive with a frigid attitude.
We didn't even have to coax him. He just came out with it right away. I love that.
Quite the Disney princess.
I love that about him.
I don't know. I'm sorry. I couldn't let it go.
Ah, oh,
man.
See?
Oh, good God. Good night, everybody. All right. So, Aaron, you've got something pretty exciting going on. The Ripley's Road Trip, believe it or not. Talk to us about what's going on and what this new programming is.
Yeah. Thanks for asking. Today we debuted this new show over at the Ripley's Believe It or Not YouTube and across their social media platforms called Ripley's Road Trip. And look, you guys know me. We've known each other for a long time. And of course, I'm a journalist, but also I love researching weird things and the paranormal. And Ripley's Road Trip kind of ties all these things together, where we're going to go to a different location with each episode. We're going to bounce around, see some of those roadside attractions and quirky elements of a town, and maybe try some of the signature food, and then explore some of the oddities, the curious curios that you can only see in those locations and that you can only see at a Ripley's Believe It or Not auditorium at those locations. And we get to talk about folklore. We're going to be interviewing a lot of local historians and authors, and maybe even getting some cool ghost stories out of it too.
Yeah, it seems a lot of the Ripley's, Believe It or Not, museums have some kind of weird paranormal activity taking place there, don't they?
Yeah, and, you know, it's not actually all that surprising when you have these elements that have been brought in from all over the world, but also have a lot of personal significance and attachment, whether it's even just something that was owned by Robert Ripley himself. They all kind of have their own energy attached to it. So it is pretty fascinating. In St. Augustine, Florida, that will be another location. That place, just the building alone, has such a haunted reputation that's going to be one I'm looking forward to.
Very cool. Now, when you're going out there and you're getting a chance to explore and see all of these different artifacts, I've always been curious at the Ripley's locations. I mean, there's quite a few of them. Are many of them replicas of original pieces from Robert Ripley's collection, or are these all original pieces from his collection?
These are original pieces, but they're not only from his private collection, because the Ripley's team is constantly scouring the world for, believe it or not, artifacts. So that could be something that has significance, such as maybe an old school Ouija board, or it could be the original lightsaber that Mark Hamill held in Star Wars. So it's not just his collection, but I will say, I did think of both of you guys when I went to the Ripley's warehouse, because it is like something out of Indiana Jones, where you're going through these massive aisles filled, all these crates on either side of you. And it's like, oh, there's a shrunken head. Oh, there's some sort of death mask. Oh, there's like this odd, like, you know, another oddity. And it's just so chock full of these treasures.
Did you think of us because you stumbled on a picture of Tim and I with hair, believe it or not?
I think that falls under the or not category, actually.
Yeah. Ouch. Very painful.
Look, there's two old radio guys.
Yeah. Here, folks, let me give you a current Ripley's Believe It or Not. As we age, the hair on our heads may vanish, but the hair in our noses and ears begins to appear magically and without invocation. Believe it or not. That's my Jack Palance for you there, Tim. I know you're a big fan.
I am. I'm a huge fan.
That was a good Jack Palance, actually. And you know, it's like he was my first exposure to Ripley's. Those and like the old books that I would get at school. And something I still love about Jack Palance is every line is somehow delivered in an inhale. Like, he just breathes in his dialogue.
Now ask Dave if he can do push-ups like Jack Palance.
I can. Those beautiful little orange ice cream push-ups.
No, not those.
15 to 20 of those in a day.
No, not like those.
Oh, you mean the one-arm push-ups he did he won the Academy Award for City Slickers?
Yep.
No.
Yep.
City Slickers, yeah.
Yeah. Believe it or not, I cannot. I think you can believe that I cannot. That's an easy part of it. Well, that's really cool. So you've been unleashed in the world. So you've joined the likes of Jack and Holly Palance, Dean Cain, and Bruce Campbell in helping to explore Ripley's. This is pretty exciting stuff, Aaron.
I mean, when you put it that way, I'm especially nervous that I'm going to screw it up. But yeah, no, it's incredibly humbling to be in this kind of this sphere of folks. And a moment that really hit me was, it was just a series of things when I was in one of these climate-controlled vaults, and I see not only, like I said, artifacts from the original Star Wars, and then I see Marilyn Monroe's dress that she wore when she sang Happy Birthday to JFK, and then there were all these little things, these stacks of shrunken heads. But really, the thing that hit home with me was when I saw Jack Palance's chair from the set of the Ripley's Believe It or Not show, and it struck me that this is a big program and a big brand to be a part of, and something that really connects me right back to my childhood.
Yeah, there was always something exciting. I remember as a kid, my grandfather would always read the newspaper and then hand me the cartoons, the funnies. And my favorite part was always going to Ripley's Believe It or Not to see what kind of strange information I could uncover this week, you know, from, headhunters to men growing horns off the top of their head to just, it was so bizarre and cool. And I would always ask my grandpa, I'd be like, so believe it or not, is this one real? Is this one real? And he'd say, well, I think all of them are real, but it's up to you to decide if you want to believe it. And I just remember having those conversations with my grandpa, and sometimes we'd laugh at the pictures that would be drawn, and we just loved that aspect. And then you had the TV series kick off, and I followed every iteration of it. I'm just fascinated by how weird and wonderful our world is.
It's true. And Robert Ripley really was a globetrotter before most people were taking to the skies, before people were exploring this world. And that tradition continues. The comics are still put out, I believe, every day. And they are all fact-based. They are believe it or not facts, but they are talking about strange elements of this world, of this gloriously weird world, and kind of exposing it to us. And I like that because, yeah, it makes us realize that it is a big world out there, and there's a lot of adventure yet to be had out there.
I am looking forward to seeing how this progresses. The first episode dropped today, correct, of this on YouTube?
That is correct. Over at the Ripley's YouTube channel and across Facebook and Twitter and wherever you absorb content.
Well, we've got it and a link for it on today's program guide so people can find it. What's your next location? Where are you off to?
Well, we're still figuring that part out, but there's a lot of, believe it or not, auditoriums out there to explore. So wherever it's going to be, it's going to be exciting, and I'll let you know as soon as we have entirely planned out.
Fantastic. Keep us in the loop. We'd love to know more about it. And maybe after the season wraps and you're done hitting up all of these locations, you can come back and we'll talk about some of the highlights for you.
I would love to. Thanks so much for having me on. And thanks for spreading the word about the Ripley's Road Trip.
Of course. And you can see Aaron Sagers and I next week at the Belvoir Winery, the Oddfellows Asylum in Liberty, Missouri. We're going to be there with the Strange Escapes events, the evening in Havana. I'm still not quite sure what that means, Aaron. So I don't know if I'm supposed to wear the dress or if you're supposed to wear the fedora. I don't know what we're supposed to do for this, but we will be there talking, having fun, and ghost hunting at the Belvoir Asylum. Are you psyched and looking forward to that?
I am. I'm getting my maracas out. I'm going to bring a cigar. I don't know. I'm going to probably lean into all the horrible Cuban stereotypes. I don't know. I'm very excited about it.
So I should wear my tuxedo and my long conga drum and come out and sing Babaloo at some point?
I mean, I think that would be worth the price of admission right there.
Little Ricky Ricardo channeling will be happening. We'll see. Well, you buy us a couple glasses of wine, you just never know what bongos I might be playing. It might be Aaron's butt bongos at the bar. So come on down, visit with us, and hang out. You can get information about it at darknessevents.com. Stay safe in that storm, buddy. I'll see you next week.
I'll talk soon, dear guys.
All right. Very cool. Hey, we've got more of your emails, and we want to hear from you. People are shy, Tim. I get emails. They're like, I've wanted to call, but I'm afraid I'm going to sound stupid. You hear these calls. They don't sound stupid. We want to hear you. And the listeners love hearing other voices besides that of mine and Tim's.
Yep.
Give us a call. Voices from Beyond Voicemail, 651-300-4977. 651-300-4977. That's the number to call. Share your paranormal encounters with us. We'll share them on the air, or you can stick with being lame and just write them down and send them in to me, and I'll read them here online at dave@darknessradio.com. You can also write a narrative, and we will feature it as an upcoming episode of Theater of the Mind. With that in mind, let's turn down the lights, pull up close to your radio, because it's time now for a new episode of Theater of the Mind.
My creation of terror, the real-life experience of Dan Hartman. I had read a book about the famed Philip experiment, the idea that thought could somehow give life to a paranormal experience, and it blew me away. I read everything I could find, watched every video out there, and decided I had to try this for myself. That proved to be the single scariest mistake of my life. I set about creating a character. I wanted to see if I could imagine a creature that I could somehow control and send to frighten my friends. What can I say? I was a stupid teenager. I was obsessed, and I just wanted to see this for myself. So I methodically planned out the character from its look to its backstory, wrote about it every day to train my mind to focus on it and to set my intention so that I could bring my creation to life. I tried to convince a few of my buddies to help me. I guess they thought this was just too weird science for them, and they declined, telling me I was just wasting my time and acting like an ass. So now I knew who my targets would be, and I couldn't wait to unfurl my little experiment on them. After close to 60 days of very intense focus and determination, I started to try and communicate with the creature. Now, I don't even want to write out the name of this thing because I'm worried it will call something back into my life that I don't ever want to face again. I began by using the Ouija. Then I went to mirror scrying, and when that didn't work, I tried conjuring it with a pentagram that I drew on my floor with powdered chalk so I could easily clean it up and not be caught by my parents. Nothing seemed to be working, or so I thought. After my fifth night of experiments, I finally gave up, sure that I had wasted my time just as my friends predicted. But it was around 2 a.m, and I was finally starting to fall asleep when I heard what could only be described as the sound of scratching coming from under my bed. At first, I thought maybe it's just a piece of paper that blew under my bed and the fan that I used to keep on for sleeping at night must just be blowing it around. Well, what can I say? It made sense to me at the time. But then
Then the scratching noises began to get louder, and they seemed to be running under the entire length of my bed, from the head of the bed to the foot and back again. I tried to convince myself that it was just my imagination and that I had spent just too much time focused on creepy things. It was starting to play with my perceptions. Then it happened. The bed thumped, like someone pushed it from under, making the bed land hard on the floor. That shook me from my near slumber and definitely caught my attention. Everything was silent except the sound of the fan. And I wondered, did I just dream that moment? Was I caught between awake and asleep? Then the bed lurched again. This time it felt like the entire frame had been thumped and sent at least 4 inches into the air. It landed with a loud thud. My heart was in my throat. My palms were instantly sweaty, and I began breathing hard. I thought to myself, what in God's name was that? That's when I saw the closet door begin to rattle. The knob seemed to be twisting back and forth. The door shook in its frame. My eyes opened to the size of baseballs as I strained to see in the dimly lit room. Then the door popped the latch and slowly squeaked open, revealing nothing but a dark, inky, gaping pit behind it. I could hear movement coming from the closet, something shuffling slowly. And then a low, steady, growling noise began from under my bed. The bed began to shake like a small tremor, and I saw what appeared to be a large, dark form slowly emerge into my room from the closet. It stood upright like a man, but it was broad. Its head was large and oddly shaped, almost like a giant dog with horns. I wanted to scream, but I couldn't. I just lay there, staring. This was just how I had imagined my creature to look. After 60 days of intense concentration, I was seeing my creation standing before me. But that didn't answer the other question. What was making my bed shake? What was underneath and shaking my bed? I was trapped. It stood there staring, and the growling from under my bed began again. I slowly raised my blankets up to my face, poked my head under there, and laid motionless, praying that whatever magical blanket gods were watching, they would be at the ready and protect me. Then the bed stopped shaking. The growl faded into the sound of the fan, and then there was silence. I laid there for what felt like hours, but I'm sure it was no more than 10 to 15 minutes, still barely breathing, when I began to lower the blanket from my face to scan my surroundings. That's when my blood ran cold. This hulking creature was positioned over my bed, reached out its claw-like hand and ripped back the blankets, leaned in slowly so its face was only inches from my own. I could see the definition in the long snout. Its glassy, large eyes stared into mine, and it sneered in a voice that was a mix between a hiss and a groan.
"Shouldn't mess with things you don't understand, boy."
I swear to God, my heart stopped. I was terrified, and then it backed up, more like floated backwards towards the door of my closet. Then it lowered its head once more and said,
"Don't make me come back. We don't play games."
And the door slammed with the might of 10 angry teenage girls. I flicked on the light in my room, and my bedroom door burst open. My parents charged in. "What the hell? It's the middle of the night. Why are you slamming doors and banging around up here?" I was speechless. I just quietly apologized and ducked back under the covers. My parents left the room, and I just lay there, staring at the ceiling, waiting for the rise of the sun. So be careful what you want to focus on, what you think about, because you may just get it.
Very cool. Welcome back to the show. Thank you very much for tuning in with us. Tim.
Yeah.
A student captured a large UFO hovering over Devon's seafront at night. Not just in a quick fleeting moment. No, for full 10 seconds, Tim. That's right. A student was left shocked after photographing a large UFO hovering for 10 seconds over the Devon seafront. Matthew Evans, 36, That's an old eighth grader, Tim, right there. 36 years old.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I'd seriously look into, I don't know, remedial classes.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Matthew Evans, 36, spotted the bright unidentified object while peeping out of his top floor flat window last week. Photographs show four bright lights in a triangular shaped formation just lingering in the night sky. And the mature student, as they put it in this article, managed to whip out his phone to take a picture. But within seconds, the suspected object whizzed off into the distance. I don't know that everyone here whip this out and whizzed in the same sentence, Tim. That usually does not go well.
Yeah, especially when it comes from two different parties, because, you know, then it's suspect.
Now, this article and this picture, Tim, I'm going to have them up on our website at darknessradio.com under the news segment. But I don't know. The skeptic in me is seeing something else. So I just sent you the picture, Tim.
Okay.
So if you want to click on it, you could see the three lights up in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
But if you notice, it's immediately above a very bright light source. And I'm not sure that it's not some kind of refractive measure from the light source. Do you see that?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Now, it's weird that the light source looks like an old 1950s UFO.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? So I don't know, but it could be two independent things. The skeptic in me says that I bet there might have been like three floodlights on that building and we're getting a refraction of them above. I'm not sure. I'm sure we have some photographic geniuses out there that can take a look at this story and let us know your thoughts, but I'm not sold, but it is a cool picture.
Well, then in two, if you look at the picture off to the right, what is that light that's off to the right?
I'm not allowed to tell you, Tim.
You're not allowed, to tell me?
No, okay. Sorry. I don't know what it is. Maybe a sail from a ship? I don't know. The mature student managed to whip out his phone as my favorite thing, and he caught it before it whizzed out, Tim.
Whizzed out.
Go take a look at it for yourself, folks. Take a look at the picture. Let me know what you think. Again, if we have any of those photographers out there, Tim, photographers that might be able to weigh in on it, I'd love to know your thoughts.
Because I can tell you... Well, I can reserve my thoughts too.
But no, if you've got a thought on it, what do you think? I it's still up in the air, like a UFO. But something just seems off to me with that picture.
I can tell you what's off about it, but it's.
Go ahead.
If there were
some skepticism on us, man,
I'll tell you. If there were colored lights, you'd know exactly what that is.
What is it?
Just by the light placement, it would look like the taillights of an airplane flying away.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah.
To a degree.
But they're not. Just by the way they're placed, if it was flying away from you, they could be the trail of jet engines.
Hmm.
So that's why it looks I'm zooming in as hard, you know, as close and as hard in as I can. That's what she said. To me, it looks if you zoom in as tight as you can, it almost looks like it doesn't look like so much as a light because they're different sizes. It almost looks like the exhaust of a fire trail. But weird. That's just me.
Well, check it out. I'm sure we've got some photographers out there. I'm sure we also have some people that are airplane specialists and might know. Let us know what you think. Go check out that news story, Dave, or at darknessradio.com, rather, and click on the news tab. Japan, Tim, is opening up a UFO lab.
Hmm.
But I don't think I want to visit at any time because it's in Fukushima.
Fukushima.
Wasn't Fukushima all leaky and stuff a few years back?
Yeah. They had a small nuclear reactor incident.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Chernobyl still closed down to people, Tim.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, like 50, 60, 80, 100 miles around is closed down. But Fukushima's like, screw that. We're putting in a UFO lab. Nearly a year after it was reported, the Japanese Defense Ministry would draw plans for any potential encounters with UFOs. The country is opening up a research lab dedicated to unexplained phenomena near the site of the Fukushima nuclear disaster. According to Japanese news outlet, the Mainichi, the International UFO Laboratory opened up on June 24th, the day before the Pentagon released its 9-page report on unidentified aerial phenomena. The lab, which is on the grounds of UFO Interactive Hall, will strive to unravel the enigma of these objects, and its director will be 51-year-old Takeharo Mikami, the editor-in-chief of Mu Occult magazine. Until now, even if UFOs were discovered, the information was shared only on an individual level, Mikami was quoted as saying by the news outlet. I hope the research lab will serve as a base receiving information and lead to new discoveries. I'd like to get to the bottom of their identity. The new lab is located in Lino, Fukushima Prefecture, just miles from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. I bet he got a really good deal on this property, Tim.
I'm thinking so, yeah. Rent was dirt cheap.
The UFO lab will look into a number of sightings that have occurred near the district, which calls itself the hometown of UFOs. In the 1970s, a light-emitting cone-shaped object was witnessed near Mount Sengamori, which eventually became known as the Mount Sengamori Incident, because it happened by Mount Sengamori, Tim. Probably. See how that happens?
Yeah.
Mikami wants residents of the area to share images with the laboratory, particularly during quarantine. Look up at the sky. See if you can see anything. I hope the Research Institute will be a base for receiving more information on UFOs so we can get to the bottom of what they are, Mikami said in a translated article from Kyoto News. In May of 2020, the Japanese Defense Ministry began to consider procedures to respond to, record, and report encounters. But the unknown nature of such objects may confuse self-defense forces pilots, including those of F-15 fighter jets, according to Nippon News. The update from the Defense Ministry came just 1 week after the Pentagon officially released 3 videos of unidentified aerial phenomena taken by Navy aircraft, which had circulated in the public for years. And last week, the long-awaited report from the Pentagon on the subject of unverified aerial phenomena, UAPs, offered no explanation for 140 of the 144 observations dating back to 2004. The declassified June 25th report, which came from the defense of the Director of National Intelligence, added that it lacks sufficient data to determine the nature of mysterious flying objects. In 18 incidents described in 21 reports, observers reported unusual UAP movement patterns or flight characteristics, the reports read. And we've kind of gone over this. The rest just rehashes the report. But interesting nonetheless. Again, I don't think Fukushima would be the hotbed of obviously it might be where the UFOs go to juice up or something.
Well, it's a hotbed, Dave. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. I mean, you're right in the middle of a nuclear reactor. And right. More importantly, Dave, as you're standing there and you're looking up in the sky to look at these UFOs, be sure to hold on to your hair and teeth because they're going to fall out quickly because of the nuclear hotbed that you're standing on.
Allegedly, Tim. Allegedly.
Allegedly, sure. But science will prove otherwise. Just saying.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hi, Dave. I'm a big fan of your work, both the podcast and the Holzer Files. You do an incredible job of blending seriousness and humor to all paranormal subjects, which makes you incredibly entertaining. Let me read that whole sentence again, Tim, just in case people tuned in late and didn't hear it. Mm. Hi, Dave. I'm a big fan of your work, both the paranormal or the podcast and the Holzer Files. You do an incredible job of blending seriousness and humor to all paranormal subjects, which makes your work incredibly entertaining, which is, I'm pretty sure, how he meant to inflect if he had read it out loud to me, Tim. I'm still laughing about the Forest Bride moment in the recent Bigfoot episode of the podcast. I have not told many people about this story, but I would consider myself a skeptical believer because while I am skeptical about a lot of evidence I have seen, I have also had a few personal experiences that are completely unexplainable. This is one of those unexplained experiences. One of the common examples of paranormal evidence that I am most skeptical of are orbs. I feel like 99% of orb photos are easily explainable and can be debunked. Investigations are conducted in old, dusty, insect-filled locations, and the vast majority of these orb photos are either dust or insects, in my opinion. Give them some applause, Tim.
You got them trained well, Dave.
Yeah, yeah. But I've also seen an actual orb with my own two eyes.
Uh-oh, Dave.
What?
Slippery slope. Go ahead.
Well, he saw him with his own two eyes. Oh, yeah. So that's better than through a camera lens.
Yeah, true.
And it was completely unexplainable. And this is that story. I was staying over at my girlfriend, now wife's house, in Hoboken, New Jersey. It was a weeknight, and we were sober, which was rare for me at the time because I was in my 20s and I enjoyed the Hoboken bar scene quite a bit. Man, that'd be a great bar band name too.
Yeah, the Hoboken bar scene. Yeah,
Hoboken bar scene. Yeah, we had just shut off the lights and we were getting ready to go to sleep, so the room was pitch black, and we were laying in bed. That's when we both saw a large ball of light in the room. The light was stationary at first. It was probably 2 feet from the ceiling and 2 or 3 feet in front of the footboard of the bed, but positioned dead center in the middle of the bed. We didn't see where it came from. It was just there. I stared at it, trying to make sense, as my wife said, "What's that? What's that?" The ball of light was bigger than a softball, but smaller than a bowling ball. It was a bright gold color and was self-illuminating. You could clearly see that it was three-dimensional. The roundness was evident. It was bright and solid and uniform in color. The orb just sat motionless in the middle of the room, almost like it was looking at us. For no more than 9 or 10 seconds, then it shot through the ceiling and it was gone. There was no sound. It looked like a large, bright, golden, three-dimensional ball just suspended in the air above the bed. Now, I know what headlights look like coming in the windows. I know what a flashlight would have looked like coming through a window, but this apartment was on the fourth floor, and with no taller buildings around, it was not a spotlight or a projector. It was a self-illuminating ball. This guy knows balls, Tim.
I guess, yeah.
I spent the next several hours trying to explain it, debunk it, but it was clearly unexplainable. And I've never seen anything like it before or since. There was no fear. There was no panic. It was almost like someone or something was just checking in on us, sitting there, watching. We were both saying, "What the heck was that?" And we're not remotely afraid. There was zero feeling of negativity or of a presence. The orb was just floating there, motionless for a few seconds, and then it shot through the ceiling and was gone. That's why a lot of supposed orbs that can be explained make me very skeptical. When you see one, and I mean really see one, there's no doubt in your mind that you've just seen something that you've never seen before that defies explanation. You know, what you saw was something different than what you've seen before. There was no, "Well, this might be," because you know what you saw cannot be explained. I'm sure that what I saw that night was paranormal in nature. I don't know what it was and cannot confirm if it was a ghost or a spirit, but it was something unexplainable. I wanted to share this story with you. Keep up the great work. I'll be watching and listening, and if you have any questions or want any additional information, please do not hesitate to reach out. That comes from Sports Smasher. Oh, no wonder he knows balls, Tim. What? He's a sports smasher.
Yeah, he's a sports smasher.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So he saw this large hovering orb of light, some kind of pervy light, was hoping these two were going to get it on.
Yeah, well.
That's what I think.
And was he paid off? Probably not.
I don't know. Probably not. Speaking of getting paid, Tim.
Yeah.
America's Got Talent judge Sofia Vergara is in utter disbelief. How, you say?
Did you say Utters and Sofia Vergara, Dave?
Stop it.
Huh?
A psychic read her mind. I'm going to throw up, she said. That's a weird response.
Yeah, it is.
Sofia Vergara might not be as terrified by having her mind read as being made to think she shot her fellow judge, but it still freaked her out pretty good. And it earned psychic Peter Anatow 4 yeses on America's Got Talent this week. Though he started his act on stage, Anatow eventually took the judges to an external location and explained that he had laid out 1,000 empty ring boxes. Simon Cowell was then tasked with hiding Vergara's engagement ring in one of those boxes. Now, neither Anatow or Vergara watched as Cowell chose which one, and then Anatow would have Vergara psychically guide him to the ring. To do so, Anatow asked Vergara to recall the memory associated with getting the ring. As the psychic began his search, he began listing what he knew about Vergara's engagement. "When you were proposed to, you weren't at home, were you? You were somewhere else. You were far away," Anatow checked in with Vergara, "and the plans had to change for your engagement." Vergara responded in the affirmative, looking shocked. Still, when the psychic selected a box, Vergara admitted that she was like 0% confident that of the 1,000 boxes, he could have possibly chosen the right one. There's no way you know that that's there, she said. And yet Anatau did indeed choose correctly, presenting Vergara with her lost ring. In doing so, she noted, or he noted another detail about the moment she got engaged to husband Joe Manganiello?
Manganiello?
Yeah, I think that's it. Joe Manganiello. I'm horrible with Italian names. He noted that when they got engaged, a rainbow appeared as he proposed. Shocked, Vergara confirmed Anatau's knowledge, stunned that he knew about the minor detail. According to Vergara, Manganiello had planned to propose by the ocean, but got nervous and ended up proposing in their hotel room. I'm going to throw up, Vergara said with a laugh when the ring was revealed. You can watch Anatau's full performance on America's Got Talent. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I'll pretty say. Interesting. Yeah.
I feel like wanting to vomit is maybe an overreaction, yeah. Sophia.
Yeah.
Vomit Gara.
Vomit Gara.
I don't know. All right, Tim, I've got an interesting, this is another one of those stories that comes to me in the form of a news story, but it's also a parashare,
okay.
Multiple parashares. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
U.S. military members are sharing their spookiest moments from serving. All right. Number one, a friend of mine went to Afghanistan and got stationed in an area that was used as a base by the Soviets. He swears that sometimes while on sentry duty, he could hear whispers that didn't sound like English or the local languages. He's convinced he heard Russian. Okay, that first story is not very terrifying.
I hope
they build from there, Tim. Yeah. Number two, one time at an Air Force base in the Republic of Korea, we had a powerful outage at night. All of us walked out of our hangar doors to see what the problem may have been, and we saw a very, very large triangular shape passing over our hangar. It was clear. It was a moonless night previously, and when we went outside to look around, we noticed the starscape being covered, then slowly uncovered. No sound was associated with the event other than normal sounds of the location. It's something I'll never forget, and that comes from Snow Goose, Tim.
Snow Goose.
Number three. This is my dad's story. After he was done in Vietnam, he was soon stationed at an Air Force base in Greenland. They often had bad blizzards there, and when they came through, the base shut down and every section of the barracks would take roll call. He said for about 5 months, every time they locked down for weather, they would hear horrendous screaming outside. Everyone was accounted for, so they didn't risk sending anyone out to investigate. They wrote it off as an animal. However, every time this was heard, the engine room would be wrecked. Tools everywhere, paperwork all over the floor, tables and toolboxes knocked over. Even one time, a several thousand pound jet engine had been lifted from its workbench crane and smashed 30 feet away. The hangars and engine room and cameras covering every single possible entrance with spotlights that made them clear even in a whiteout. No animals, no people, no anything was ever seen entering or leaving those buildings. And then one day, it just stopped. That's a pretty good one.
That
comes from Creepy Redditor Loner. Number four, U.S. Navy photographer here in the deepest parts of the ocean, you will often see steam past small boats that are empty or seemingly empty. Sometimes they look like they got loose or no one looked for them. Sometimes they look disgusting, like someone lived in them until they couldn't. Sometimes it's obvious because someone is still in them, but they haven't moved for weeks. That comes from Lightwolf. Not very scary, Lightwolf. You're going to have to step up your game if you want to be a part of this list.
Yeah.
Number five, I'm not in the military, but I did read Hal Moore's book, We Were Soldiers Once, and Young, and there were multiple instances of North Vietnamese soldiers just walking straight up to U.S. forces in the middle of combat. They'd look at them, and they wouldn't even raise their weapon or unsling it. They would just start laughing at U.S. soldiers. Then the U.S. guys would shoot them. I'm sure there's a reasonable explanation of why this happened, but it's pretty creepy that the enemy might just walk up to you and start laughing in your face, seemingly not caring whether you shoot them or not. And that comes from Evan466, Tim.
That's a little creepy.
That is weird.
Yeah.
That's very weird.
Yeah.
Number six, we wrote it off as some of the instructors messing with us, but while training at the JWTC, the Jungle Warfare Training Center, there was a blood-curdling scream in the middle of the night. It definitely sounded like a woman. The lieutenant in charge made us do a quick accountability check. Then he started radioing the training center to see what the hell happened. The instructors went out from their compound and did some checks, but they couldn't find anything. They said it's not the first time that they had units out there calling in to report the exact same thing. And that comes from Boss Avery. You got to work on that name, boss. Good story. Lame name. I was on the rooftop, number seven starts, on a post with another Marine, and on the building next to mine was a dude smoking a cigarette. I looked at my partner to mention it, but when he looked again, he was gone. The roof access door for that building was very rusty and loud. There's no way he snuck out in those few seconds it took my partner to get his attention. That comes from I'm M.A. Reyes. Number eight. Stayed in the barracks the Germans used to house Polish prisoners of war. I'd regularly put things in places only to find them in the middle of the floor after leaving the room. And that comes from deleted Tim. Number nine, one of my drill sergeants actually has a creepy story from one of his Afghanistan deployments. He was infantry, so being in the field and out on missions for multiple weeks wasn't uncommon. One night while sleeping in a fighting position he dug, he felt something nibbling at his feet. He woke up and kicked it off, and what he saw wasn't any type of marsupial, but a little humanoid figure he could only describe as looking like Gollum. But being in the field with little sleep, he chalked it up to just seeing things. A couple of days later, he and another guy were on watch, and the other guy pointed out something and said, "What the fuck is that?" and pointed at a stone wall in the distance. My drill sergeant looked through his binoculars, and crawling across the top of the stone wall was the exact little humanoid creature that had nibbled his toes just a few nights before. Creepy, psycho little toe nibblers, Tim.
Yeah.
Number 10, I was a military police officer stationed in Germany. We would get calls every now and then of a woman and or child screaming in the vicinity of the high school on post. When we would get there, nothing would be happening and none of our German gate guards heard a thing. Occasionally, we'd have to go search the high school to make sure nobody was in it after hours. Doorknobs were known to be spinning all the way around with nobody turning them. We'd also get calls about hearing screaming from a Polish POW cemetery on post, which was off a dirt road from an almost never used area of the training area. We'd get there and it'd always be foggy as shit with nobody there. And that comes from Hopeless Rebel 2187. Number 11, the U.S. Air Force here. Not allowed to say what I do, but my airframe flew in Vietnam and carried dead bodies back. And after Vietnam, it was repurposed. All of the older frames from that era are supposedly haunted from these dead soldiers. I've spent mid-shift, midnight to 7 a.m. on these frames, and I've heard people screaming in pain. I've asked for a tool and had someone hand it to me and then turned around, but there was no one there. Multiple times you'll hear someone's name being called. I don't believe in ghosts, but those frames creep me the fuck out. That comes from Peripheral Wall.
Yeah, don't blame them. That's creepy. Mm-hmm.
No. There's nothing creepier than wanting a tool and having somebody hand it to you.
Yeah.
Number 12, when I was deployed, we worked out of an ancient dock from the Vietnam era. I worked graveyard, so there was never any people there at night except mission essential for any missions we were running. We would randomly hear footsteps walking down the small hallway that was a dead end. Our door was the last one before the little bit that was the dead end. No one ever walked past our door, but there were always the footsteps. Then one night, there were wet footprints down there. And it wasn't even raining outside, Tim. There was no rain at all, Tim. Comes from Anonymous. Number 13. Back in 2012, I was lucky enough to be a private in the Army in Afghanistan. One night, we get this very weird transmission. It came in pretty strong, and we couldn't determine from what direction it was coming in. However, what truly made it odd was what was being said. Now, I'm no linguist, but I know enough about different languages to know this was straight up Russian. We heard a recording device and managed to catch most of the broadcast before it stopped completely. We didn't have any Russian linguists with us. We sent a copy of the recording over the protected high side computer system to get information translated. I knew that one of the warrant officers in my unit was also a Russian linguist back from the Cold War era and had him listen as well. He was rusty, but got the gist of the message. It was a distress call asking for help that their base was being overrun and being attacked. And that comes from Heinvaja. Number 14, I saw a UFO when I was in basic training at Fort Leonard Wood. I was walking from one building to another to start my fire watch shift when I noticed something as bright as a star making a zigzag pattern at impossible speeds and then suddenly just disappear over the horizon. I'd never been more clear-headed and sober in my life, so I'm sure I saw something. And that is Zomig Sauce, please. I don't know how to say the word. Number 15. In Okinawa, there are places on the island that the local national gate guards will not stand post on during certain times of day because of dead Japanese soldiers during the war. There were also supposedly places where, again, dead Japanese soldiers will walk up asking for a cigarette. Never saw it personally, but you never know. That comes from Pennywise 1235. Number 16, as a Marine, I used to have the graveyard patrol shift at the Beirut Memorial at Camp Lejeune. Oddly enough, I never got freaked out being completely alone in a remote cemetery in the middle of the night, surrounded by dense woods on all sides. However, one night, I was patrolling near the perimeter fence when some of the oldest headstones are located, when I heard the sound of a woman humming. I followed the sound and noticed a light glowing through the vines and brush of a large tree. As I approached, I could literally feel my hair beginning to lift as if it was a static current in the air. I pushed aside the brush, and what I saw nearly took my breath away. It was an old weathered headstone with a large cross etched into the marble. Only the cross was glowing a bright, vivid blue like a neon bulb. The humming was also suddenly much louder and had a weird plurality to it, like it was coming from hundreds of voices at once. Needless to say, I freaked the beep out, and I screamed like a scared little girl, sprinted back to the parking lot, and that came from Rainbow Grimm. Number 17, I was by myself in the engine room of a submarine on the midwatch. I came down one of the ladders, and I swore someone walked across the ship about 15 feet in front of me. I could hear his footsteps as he walked around a corner and out of sight. Now, there's three problems. One, he was wearing utilities, an older, lighter blue blouse and dark navy slacks. Nobody had utilities anymore. They had all been phased out 3 years earlier. Two, there was only one person awake in the engine room that late at night, and he was standing at the top of the ladder behind me, waiting for me to come back up with an answer to his question. Number three, he wasn't actually there. Fast forward to 4 months later, I met a sailor on a different submarine who had previously served on my ship. After a few weeks of us standing watch together, he told me a story of a sailor who had committed suicide while on watch when he served on my ship almost a decade earlier in the engine room lower level while wearing his utilities. Mm-hmm. And that comes from Ice Sir.
It's a good one.
Number 18. We're coming into the end, Tim.
Okay.
Two stories left. Used to be an F-22 avionics for the U.S. Air Force at an undisclosed base. A light appeared above the flight line, moving in an odd way, hovering. We called it into our number one, and he called another AMU's aircraft maintenance unit to ensure that there were no sorties being flown that we didn't know about. Shortly after, F-22s and F-16s were scrambled, but could not intercept the object. It was disappearing into the night. We saw this go down from our flight line. Shortly after, we were informed this never happened. And number 19. Hi, from the Navy here. I was roving the barracks at night. I had a UI under instruction, so I was showing him the ropes. Well, on the second or third floor of the barracks, there is a recreation room with a TV and chairs and a piano. Mind you, everyone was asleep, and it was 0200 in the morning. Well, I decided to go and see if I remembered how to play the piano a little. We started walking down the hall when we heard a single piano note go off. We both heard it while I was in mid-conversation, so we kind of looked back, and then we both looked to see each other and see if we had heard the same noise. We shrugged it off as our imaginations running wild, but as soon as we got to the end of the hall and opened the doorway to the stairway, a sharp keynote was heard coming from down the hall in the direction of the room with the piano. We left the floor as soon as possible and later shared the story with some shipmates. They told the stories of sailors who died in those barracks. And that comes from Compact 2598. I'm a little bummed that the military that's seen some stuff, Tim.
Yeah.
Those were the scariest of their stories. Come on. Come on, military. Creep me out more.
Well, you know, I wouldn't expect that the dead would rise and start dancing on a ship. I mean, it's not Broadway. But
what a lame imagination you have, Tim.
Well, but, you know, I mean, those are...
It's close to midnight.
There's some good little creepers in there.
Yeah, there's a couple of them.
Yeah.
This next chilling story is from the Surreal Estate set, and it'll make you a believer in ghosts, Tim. In an exclusive chat with E! News, Tim Rosin and Sarah Levy shared behind-the-scenes tidbits from the Surreal Estate set, including an in-real-life ghost story. Putting the surreal in Surreal Estate. In an exclusive chat with E! News, Tim Rosin and Sarah Levy, who are starring in Sci-Fi's upcoming paranormal drama, revealed that supernatural occurrences didn't just happen for the camera. According to the Schitt's Creek alums, the cast were the stars of a real-life ghost story after several guest stars found themselves staying at a haunted hotel. Tim, who plays Luke Roman, a real estate agent with an expertise in haunted homes, said he wasn't a believer in ghosts. That is, until now. You know, it's so funny because my answer 100% before starting this was no. That's what he told E! News. After doing the show, filming where we did in Newfoundland, I heard so many stories from guest stars. Supposedly, where everybody was flying in and staying was an old haunted mansion turned into a hotel. And I heard stories from almost every guest star that they had said they felt some sort of presence that didn't feel natural. It's hard for me to not believe everybody, you know? In fact, one guest star checked out of the hotel he was in because it was too spooky. He was like, I'm out of here. This place is way too creepy. That's what Sarah told Susan Ireland and noted not everyone that stayed there had the same feeling, but it was really intense. I was so grateful that I wasn't one of the ones staying there. Although Sarah called herself a believer, even she was surprised to learn of the eerie history of the town that they were filming in. St. John's, Newfoundland and Labrador, Canada, where we were staying. It is notoriously haunted base on all the stories that a lot of people that live there have, she shared. That was a weirdly written sentence. I mean, I talked to everybody, and it seems like 99% of the locals I have talked to have at least one story. While Sarah made it clear that the area couldn't have been more beautiful, she did admit that they were shooting in a place that was already pretty eerie to begin with. If we weren't sold on Surreal Estate before, we are now. According to this article, back in May, Sci-Fi released the first trailer for the new drama, which features Tim and Sarah as real estate agents that specialize in selling homes with supernatural tendencies. The first look teased everything from ghosts to hellfires to demonic children. I didn't know my kids were starring in that show, Tim.
Well, you know, they decided to pick up a little work around the house and, you know, make things a little easier for you.
Now I'm going
to
call BS. My kids have never once picked up a little work around my house. Never. Never.
It's a belated Father's Day gift. They just decided, you know, take a little load off the old man and just bring in a little work, you know?
Take a load off daddy. Take a load for free.
You're not buying that, huh?
No, not at all.
Okay.
The Headless Horseman of Coinsborough has been captured on camera, Tim. For a paranormal research association have been investigating the legend of a town's headless horseman who was part of the Battle of Maysbury Battlefield in 487. Now, association founder Dean Buckley, partner medium Veronica Buckley, and paranormal investigator Jane Danby have carried out three investigations so far into this legendary figure, who is described as being a Saxon with strawberry blonde hair and a beard, who was chased by several figures across the fields and lost his life on the field next to the garden. Now, this is pretty creepy. I'm going to show you this picture in a second, Tim.
Okay.
All right. Now, Veronica has spoken to the horseman twice on two investigations, and the spirit told her his horse was injured in the attack by an arrow. Dean explained, during the investigation, I felt so much sadness and fear with him that I think these were his last emotions. At the field on Garden Lane, we heard the galloping of the horses. How was that? Pretty good?
Just sounds like your tongue going up and down, but okay.
Shut up. It's my horse noises. It was dark and very quiet, but the horse's hooves were clear, and we all heard them like this. Or do you prefer this noise, Tim?
No.
Oh. The image of the horseman was taken by Dean, who was actually visited by the spirit and was photographed in his back garden. In those days, my back garden would have been fields. I heard a horse twice in a few minutes, so I went outside, and me, being me, snapped three photos. And he appeared in the second. The group intends to carry out a final investigation into the Headless Horseman at three other locations at the end of the summer, with Paul Bell joining them. All right, so I can hear the skepticism in your voice as well, Tim. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to tell you, this picture is pretty freaking compelling. Are you ready for this?
Okay.
All right, take a look. And for those of you listening, go to darknessradio.com, click on the news tab, scroll down until you see the story that's titled The Headless Horseman of Coinsboro, captured on camera. That's a pretty compelling picture, man.
Mm.
Dude, you could totally see a horse and a guy bent over the horse with no head, Tim.
I see somebody's cigarette smoke is what I see. I guess
well, that cigarette smoke looks like a horse and a headless horseman, Tim. I've never seen in an area that's known to have a headless horseman ghost cigarette smoke that just happens to curl up into a headless horseman ghost, Tim. But I could be wrong.
Yeah.
Oh, so you want something scarier, Tim Dennis?
Yeah.
That's not good enough for you? No. Well, how about if we go to a haunted Woolworth store, Tim?
Okay, that'd be better. I'll take that.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. The building is supposedly haunted by a Victorian girl named Annie. Annie, are you okay? Are you okay, Annie?
I think she was
asking her if she'd eaten her oatcakes.
Yeah, has she eaten her oatcakes? Yeah.
Annie, eat your oatcakes. Annie, eat your oatcakes. Eat your oatcakes, Annie. A former Woolworths worker has spoken of her haunted experience at the shop during the 70s. Ann Partridge, 68, of Hanson Close, described how she had experiences with the paranormal in both the top floor and cellar. She began working at the store on Sheep Street, Rugby, back in 1969. We were all told when we first arrived about the haunting, she revealed. Rumor had it that the ghost of a girl in a Victorian-style dress called Annie haunted the stockroom on the third floor. Legend said she hung herself on a nearby stairwell in the 1800s and continued to walk around the building. You just hated going up on that top floor. The manager of the store used to say, "Don't be afraid, she won't hurt you." Everybody else would say, "Don't go up to the top floor on your own." One Christmas, we were all doing an audit. There were three of us on the top floor. We were all busy and the door opened and we went through and thought someone had come in. You could hear someone walking up the first aisle, walk back, and then the door closed, but there was no one there. We just said, "Yeah, we're going now." The cellar wasn't much better, according to Anne. She told how long before a boy had allegedly fallen down the outside lift and died. He just wanted to walk around, she said. If you were down there, you would sometimes go cold. One time, me and another girl were standing in the cellar, and it felt as if someone brushed in between us. I turned around and said, "Did you push me?" And she said, "No, you pushed me." It was almost a half century since Anne last worked there, but the tale of Annie has long lived past then. One employee who worked at Woolworths from 2005 to 2007, a year before it closed down, told of just how eerie it really was. The stock rooms were so dank and gloomy, which obviously made it a bit more ominous. "I mainly worked the tills, so I didn't have to go up there every so often," thankfully, he said. "I never personally saw an apparition, but the third floor stock room was always eerily quiet. I always felt like I was being watched. Maybe ghost hunters should go looking for Annie. Who knows?" The story carries on to this day with other past employees sharing their experiences online. "I remember all the freaky stuff that happened in the stockrooms. Freaky, 100% haunted," commented one. "I used to go up until toys started going off on their own, and then I saw a face in the window on the lift, and I was done. I quit." Since Woolworth's closure in 2008, its premises has been occupied by 99p stores. That's like a 99-cent store, Tim.
Yeah.
Before becoming Poundland. That sounds like a dirty bookstore.
I'll take a trip to Poundland.
Like you haven't already been there? Now it lies empty, but according to some, not completely empty. Yeah. Yeah, Woolworth's ghost stories weren't very chilling, Tim. Sorry.
No.
Yep. All right, Tim, here we are. Our final story of the day. A mentally unstable man makes odd police request against paranormal. You heard that right, Tim. From anywhere in the globe, there will be odd requests made that includes encounters where some individuals from Gujarat would claim that ghosts are often after them. One such incident reportedly happened over in Vadodara. It's a tough one to say. Vadodara. Yeah. Oh. The 35-year-old man reportedly filed an odd complaint with the Jumbagahoda police station in Panchmakal district on Tuesday, alleging that he was being harassed by a gang of ghosts. He sought aid from authorities, believing his life was in danger. The man claims that he was approached by the paranormal figures while he was working on the farm. The man was identified as Varasbingai Bariasalo. Police were surprised with the unusual request, but had suspected something mentally off. To save him from further distress, police logged the complaint to assuage his fears. He was very agitated. It was clear that he was behaving abnormally. We took down the application and showed it to him to calm down, according to PSI Manahishika Thakur. Now, moments later, authorities contacted the family of Bayer Oslo. They found out that the family had no idea that the 35-year-old went to the police and revealed that the man was undergoing psychiatric treatment. Also, that Varangazabai, are you buying these names, Tim?
No.
Varangazabai had allegedly not taken his medicine for the past 10 days. So does this mean that he was legitimately seeing the ghosts, Tim? Now, other family members say that they do feel and sense things. Was the lack of medication allowing him to see through the veil and uncover the truth that's around us all the time?
No. Mm-hmm. No.
No. All right.
No.
Fine. Well, that's it for Supernatural News Parashare edition today. I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as we enjoyed bringing it to you. We'll be back tomorrow, Tim. We have and I'm going to be upfront with people. We have a very interesting conversation with a medium psychic out of the UK. We're going to talk about some touchy subjects. So there are some triggers, but I think people might be interested in hearing this. Afterlife insights into suicide, murder, trauma with our guest Siobhan Smith. That's tomorrow on the Best in Paranormal Talk Radio. Again, there'll be no live show tomorrow night, but I will be live in person in Duluth. Duluth is on fire. So come on out and see me. You can get tickets to the event that's taking place at the Minnesota Para Unity Conference and Convention at the Duluth Convention Center. It's this coming weekend. I'm going to be out there along with a lot of other great guests from the paranormal field. Love to meet you. I've got free hugs in mind for you if you're swinging by, so make sure you stop in. Our buddy Chris Fleming's going to be there. I believe Steve Gonzalez is going to be there from Ghost Hunters, Ghost Nation, and the rebooted Ghost Hunters. It's coming back out. So there's a lot of cool guests that are going to be on hand, and I hope you guys will come on out and check out our website, darknessevents.com, to keep up on all the different locations we'll be visiting throughout the year. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. Thank you very much to Gare Allen for joining us today and Aaron Sagers. And remember to check out the links on today's program guide to find Gare's book and to watch Ripley's Road Trip with Aaron Sagers. This is Darkness Radio.